Thank you for tuning in to The Sun Also Rises here on KPCG 101.3 FM. I'm your host, Jeremiah Jacques, and today we'll start off by looking at a major problem that was afflicting the world for hundreds of years, causing unspeakable suffering for hundreds of thousands of people. So let's hoist the canvas, set the compass true, and lift our spyglass steady on the Barbary Pirates. For centuries, these Islamic pirates, based in North Africa, terrorized the world. They terrorized the world ruthlessly and relentlessly. The Barbary Pirates were based in what today is called Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco. And by the late 1400s, they were active in great force. And they remained terrifyingly belligerent for centuries. Anyone on a ship anywhere within their reach, whether that was in the vicinity of Africa's Atlantic coast or in the Mediterranean Sea along Africa's north coast, anyone who sailed in those regions sailed under constant threat. They could be attacked by these Barbary pirates and killed, or more often, enslaved. Yes, these African pirates enslaved hundreds of thousands of people, mostly Christian Europeans, during their centuries of terror. And actually, you didn't even have to be out at sea on a ship to be at risk. Sometimes the Barbary pirates would conduct what they called razzias. These were raids on European coastal villages and towns. This happened mainly on the coasts of Italy, France, Portugal, and Spain, but sometimes even as far north as Britain, Ireland, and even Iceland. And the numbers here are stunning. The numbers show that this was no small operation, but a broad scale and extremely destructive blight on the world. These pirates had the backing of their Islamic governments and also the mighty Ottoman Empire. So this was not sporadic bouts of crime perpetrated by ragtag misfits. No, this was a vast and sustained enterprise. The American historian Robert Davis examines this in his book, Holy War and Human Bondage. And his data shows that from the years 1530 to 1780, the Barbary pirates enslaved as many as 1,250,000 people, who were mostly Christian Europeans. Some of these captives were forced to work for and kill for the pirates, or to be soldiers for the Ottoman Empire in some other capacity. But most of them were sold in slave markets in Tripoli or Algiers, sold to become concubines or laborers of various kinds. So the Barbary pirates were building a slave empire. There was often some ransoming, with the captives who came from wealthier families being bought back out of slavery. But the poorer captives, most of them, generally died as slaves. One of the most famous captives of the Barbary pirates was a Spanish man named Miguel de Cervantes. This was several years before Cervantes wrote his novel, Don Quixote, that would go on to become one of the most influential and enduring literary works of all time. Years before that novel's publication, Cervantes spent 5 grueling years as a captive to the Barbary pirates. That was from 1575 to 1580. And he was only freed after his family was finally able to work with a Christian group and come up with enough money to ransom him. So Cervantes was the most famous captive, but he was far from alone, one of well over 1 million. So the Barbary corsairs, or pirates, they were a major blight on the world, a scourge that afflicted not only Europe, but any powers trading with the Europeans, including those in North America. Before the United States won its independence, the American colonists enjoyed the protection of Great Britain's Royal Navy. But that safeguard ended abruptly in 1776. and left American vessels to fend for themselves against the numerous, well-established, and well-armed Barbary pirate crews. And after all of the tea that the Americans spilled into the Boston Harbor, the Brits even spilled some of their own. They quietly spread word to the pirates that U.S. ships were no longer under their protection. It's also important to note that the motivation of many of the Barbary pirates was not just to pillage and plunder and grow wealthy. It wasn't just financial gain. In many cases, they were also driven by religious ideology, Islamist ideology. You know, Muslims during these centuries considered themselves to be waging holy war against European Christians, just as the Christians saw themselves as waging holy war against the Muslims. So the Barbary pirates, as they pillaged and plundered and burned villages and killed and enslaved Europe's men, women, and children, they didn't just think that it was justified. They thought that it was righteous. And they perpetrated all of that evil while thinking that God was on their side, cheering them on from above. So these North African pirates really saw themselves as waging Islamic naval jihad. And those beliefs, of course, intensified their zeal and ambition and their ruthlessness. In 1793, an Algerian slaver captured an American seaman named John Foss and his crew. And the Algerian man said, "Now I have got you, you Christian dogs. You shall eat stones." So you can see a bit of the religious aspect of this campaign on display there. To the Muslims, these captives were Christian dogs, and many of them in captivity were treated actually much worse than dogs. After 3 years in captivity, John Foss enumerated the punishments that he and his fellow Christian slaves suffered at the hands of the Barbaries. He wrote, "Impalement upon an iron stick thrust up through, having one's head chopped off, castration, being cast off the walls of the city upon an iron hook, and nailed to the gallows by one hand and opposite foot." And then Foss goes on saying, "Of course, these were the worst of the punishments. Often, floggings and random beatings were the everyday form of punishment." End quote. Now, some European nations did try to purchase safety from the Barbary pirates. They would pay tribute to them in order to safeguard their ships and their coastal towns. But the Barbary's prices kept going up, and their promises were little more than wind and spray, loud in the gust, but gone with the tide. Paying tribute reduced attacks and enslavements, but never eliminated them. So the Barbary pirates terrorized the seas year after year, decade after decade, and century after century. But then, as the calendar page turned from the 1700s to the 1800s, on the opposite end of the Atlantic Ocean, currents were shifting. Now, the United States at this time was a newly launched republic, just about 25 years old. America was struggling with economic fragility and political division, and it was still finding its sea legs, trying to establish its position in the choppy waters of international relations. America's first couple of administrations had experimented with paying tribute to the Barbary corsairs. From 1795 to 1800, they actually paid almost $2 million to the Barbary pirates, which was just an exorbitant amount of money at the time, especially considering the very lean size of the U.S. government. But with the tolls ever rising, and with the guarantees never truly guaranteed, the patience of many Americans had run aground. "The more you give, the more the Turks will ask for." Those were the words of U.S. Army officer William Eaton. He wrote that around the turn of the century, and it was a reality that William Eaton understood firsthand. From 1797 to 1801, he worked as consul general to Tunis, in modern Tunisia, with the goal of negotiating better terms for American commerce. So Eaton beheld the scourge of the Barbary pirates with his own eye. He gazed upon their black work firsthand and knew their measure. And as the pirates' demands and barbarity increased, he became one of the loudest critics of the tribute system. He warned that for the young United States of America, paying tribute was a course with no safe harbor. American statesman Thomas Jefferson agreed with Eaton's view. In one of his letters from the late 1700s, Jefferson wrote, "I am very unwilling that we should acquiesce to the European humiliation of paying tribute to those lawless pirates." When Jefferson became president in 1801, he carried those sentiments with him. He resolved to answer Barbary terrorism not with gold, but with the cut of steel. On May 13th of 1801, Jefferson deployed a small squadron from the nation's 25-year-old navy to the Mediterranean Sea. Their orders were as follows: chastise their insolence by sinking, burning, or destroying their ships and vessels wherever you shall find them. Now, the Barbary pirates by this point had been operating for more than 300 years, and they had nearly 100 battle-hardened crews sailing expertly designed ships, calling on robustly fortified bases, and enjoying cover from those Islamist-ruled, Ottoman-aligned regencies. The Americans, on the other hand, had three frigates and a schooner, and no ground troops to support maritime operations. So this was an extremely difficult commission Jefferson gave them, a very David and Goliath task. And though some battles were won in the early years, the outcomes were mixed. And in 1803, the USS Philadelphia was lost, and its crew captured by the Barbary pirates. The decisive victory that Jefferson and the rest of America sought remained a figment on the horizon, sighted at dawn, swallowed by dusk. A real victory seemed terribly elusive, but in 1804, William Eaton returned to the Mediterranean region, this time not as a diplomat, but with the commission of a Navy lieutenant. And he brought with him an audacious plan. Ruling over Tripoli and other parts of modern-day Libya at this time was a man named Yusuf Karamanli. Yusuf Karamanli had seized power in the early 1790s, first by killing his oldest brother, Hassan, in front of their mother, no less, and then by exiling his second oldest brother, Hamet, who was next in line. So Hamet was exiled to Egypt, and Yusuf then established himself in Tripoli as a major perpetuator and power broker of the Barbary, pirate, and slave system. So this was a dark sibling rivalry, and in it, William Eaton saw an opportunity for America. He reckoned that if the U.S. could restore Hamet Karamanli to power, then the Americans would have a major ally in the region and could weaken or even eradicate piracy at one of its strongest ports. So it was a viable plan, a plan with good timber in it. But the trouble was, a battle against Yusuf Karamanli's fortified coastal cities could not be won from the sea alone. The Americans would also need boots on the ground. And if the plan failed, not only would the ships and crews of America's fledgling navy be in jeopardy, but the land troops supporting Hamet would be stranded deep in hostile territory. Eaton requested that a contingent of 100 Marines join him in order to place the success beyond the caprice of incident. Those were his words. And Jefferson authorized the mission, but Eaton was given just 7 Marines, 7 instead of 100. But he was not deterred, and with this modest detachment, Eaton traveled to Egypt and he met with Hamet in Alexandria. Hamet, for his part, was enthusiastic. He required little persuasion to rally behind this plan, and he helped Eaton recruit some Greek and Arab mercenaries to support their modest numbers. Eaton and Hamet then put their heads together and determined that the city of Derna on Libya's coast would be the place for them to first confront Yusuf's forces and to install Hamet to power. So the plan was coming together, but seizing the city of Derna was only half the battle. Reaching the city on foot would be every bit as treacherous. Well, on March 6th of 1805, Eaton and Hamet, along with the 7 Marines, began walking westward from Alexandria, Egypt, toward Derna. With them were nearly 400 Arab mercenaries and 67 Greek mercenaries, as well as 190 camels bearing weapons and supplies. Their destination was 500 miles of cruel desert away, and the trek happened to coincide with the Khamsin season, when a scorching Saharan wind whips sand northward across the desert, relentlessly battering anyone unsheltered. In these conditions, this motley crew managed to cross fewer than 20 miles each day. And this was a truly arduous journey. Not even 2 weeks into it, their supplies were dwindling and rations had to be reduced. Eaton wrote in his journal saying, "We have marched a distance of 200 miles through an impossible waste of world without seeing the habitation of an animated being or the tracks of man. Over burning sand and rocky mountains, our only provisions are a handful of rice and 2 biscuits a day." They slaughtered every camel they could spare without losing the means to carry the weaponry that they would depend on in Derna and the other supplies. Still, the hunger of so many men burning through endless calories raged on. Locating water also proved to be a constant battle. One of the Marines described a long belated drink from a putrid puddle as more delicious than the most precious cordial. Several days later, the group found a cistern, and they were delighted beyond words to see it, until they noticed that its water was contaminated by the rotting corpses of 2 apparently murdered men. Eaton wrote, "We were obliged, nevertheless, to use the water." At another point, the men went 47 hours without a single drop. Very dangerous in those kinds of conditions. But this weary, sand-pelted, desiccated column trudged on. They pressed on toward the opportunity to face gunshot, cannon fire, slashings, capture, torture, and death. On one occasion, hunger and thirst, and also concerns about their pay, compelled a number of the Arab mercenaries to raid the group's food supply. The Marines were able to beat them back with the help of the Greeks, but only narrowly. And in the aftermath of that, many Arabs left the group to return to Egypt. In the weeks that followed, Eaton faced 2 more attempted mutinies, and at one point, Hamet himself even packed up his tent, demoralized, vowing to return to Alexandria. But Eaton was eventually able to persuade him to press ahead. Then in late April of 1805, after almost 7 weeks of crushing slog, the group reached the port city of Bamba. Their bodies were gaunt, stomachs empty, strength nearly gone. Cater Miller is the curator of the National Museum of the Marine Corps in Virginia, and he says completing the march was a miracle itself. So it was a miracle, but they made it to Bamba. This is just a few dozen miles east of Derna, their real destination. And in Bamba, the men spotted 3 faint shapes floating on the horizon: the USS Hornet, the USS Argus, and the USS Nautilus. These ships were sailing their way toward shore with food and water. Eaton wrote in his journal about how it felt to see these three ships heading their way. He said, "Language is too poor to paint the joy and exaltation." The American sailors provided Eaton's men food, water, pay for the mercenaries, hope, and a promise spoken like fair wind. They promised that they would join in the battle ahead by providing offshore bombardment. On April 23rd, Eaton's group left Bamba, much refreshed, to walk the final miles to Derna. And then 2 days later, they were upon the city. Several sheiks came out of the city to the American camp to swear their loyalty and that of two-thirds of the city's population to Hamet Karamanli. But these sheiks also brought some grim news. They said that the city's governor, a man called Mustafa Bey, was staunchly aligned with Hamet's younger brother, the murderous and usurping Yusuf Karamanli. And they said that Mustafa commanded 800 soldiers and formidable artillery, and that those 800 would soon be reinforced by a force from Yusuf that was fast advancing from Tripoli. This was sobering to hear, but Eaton thought he may be able to reason with Mustafa Bey. So he had a message delivered to him. The message said, "I want no territory. With me is advancing the legitimate sovereign of your country. Give us a passage through your city, and supplies of which we shall need, you shall receive fair compensation. Let no differences of religion induce us to shed the blood of harmless men who think little and know nothing." End quote. So Eaton hoped that Mustafa Bey might let them pass on toward Tripoli. But Mustafa was unimpressed with Eaton's message. His reply to Eaton was very short. Wasting no words, he said, "My head or yours." At this reply, many of Eaton and Hamet Karamanli's remaining Arab mercenaries decided this was a fight that they did not want to risk. So they fled. They took up what Eaton called a retrograde march. This was a terrible blow to the group, losing all these men who were supposed to help them win the battle ahead. But Hamet Karamanli and his entourage remained, and so did the Greek mercenaries. And at dawn on April 27th, what was left of the group awoke to the reassuring sight of those three U.S. warships afloat off Derna, prepared for combat. At the same time, Eaton received word that Yusuf's reinforcements were en route from Tripoli and that they were only 2 days away. This was believed to be around 1,200 men, so Eaton knew that the time to strike was now, before those other forces had time to arrive. One of the three U.S. warships delivered a couple of field pieces to Eaton's forces, cannons that were small enough for the men to move around. And then the crews of those warships piloted them near to the Derna shoreline, and favorable winds allowed them to anchor remarkably close. At the same time, the Americans and Greeks took up forward positions. By this time, the force was down to perhaps as few as 80 total men, and they knew they would be fighting 800 of Mustafa's men in well-defended positions, so this was literally 10 to 1 in favor of the Barbary Corsair forces. Cater Miller wrote about this, saying, "Assaulting a fortified coastal city with a handful of Marines, bolstered by a mercenary army against numerically superior defenders, was a tremendous gamble. But however long the odds, Eaton's crew was determined to see their mission through or die in the attempt." So around 1:30 in the afternoon, Mustafa's forces opened fire on the anchored U.S. ships. and the Americans thundered back, bombarding the town with cannon fire. Eaton and First Lieutenant Presley O'Bannon led the Marines and Greeks, and they used those two field pieces, as well as their muskets, to deliver coordinated fire on Mustafa's men from positions along the town's perimeter. The battle raged, with muskets cracking, cannons thundering, and blades singing their thin, terrible music. The ground trembled under the cannon's roar, and the air grew heavy with smoke and ash, tasting of sulfur, reeking of doom. But within 45 minutes, the U.S. cannons had silenced Mustafa's city batteries. His artillerymen abandoned their positions to turn their attention and their rifles toward the Marines. Very soon, Eaton and O'Bannon and their men were nearly pinned down by heavy musket fire from Mustafa's forces, with the musket balls lashing the ground around them. And with their field pieces moving too slowly, Eaton gave a desperate order. Charge! He described this moment in his diary, writing, "We rushed forward against a host of savages more than 10 to our one." Seconds into the charge, a Barbary bullet mangled Eaton's wrist. But he and the men that he led charged on, and Mustafa's defenders were left with a grim choice: stand and fight or flee for their lives. The unyielding resolve of the advancing men broke their nerve. Mustafa's forces chose flight. They began running out of the city, and the Americans captured the Barbary's main battery overlooking the port. And some of them saw Mustafa Bey fleeing Derna alongside what was left of his forces. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, U.S. Marines held the city of Derna. O'Bannon tore down the Barbary's flag from the ramparts. And then, for the first time in history, the Marines raised an American flag over a conquered city on foreign soil. The triumph was spectacular, but they had paid for it in blood. Marine Private John Wilton was killed in the assault, and Private Edward Stewart was mortally wounded. And then besides Eaton, Corporals David Thomas and Bernard O'Brien were also wounded, as were 9 of the Greeks. But the Battle of Derna was an improbable and awesome victory against wicked piracy and terrorism. And it is famously celebrated to this day in the Marines' hymn, a verse of which says,
"From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, we fight our country's battles in the air, on land and sea."
Thomas Jefferson's decision to fight the pirates, rather than paying them, signaled to the world that America was ready to stand up to foreign threats. This strengthened national pride, and it established America as an emerging naval power. This was a part of America's explosion onto the world stage in the early 1800s, as a power to be reckoned with. Now, it is true that the Barbary pirates and their brutal slavery would not be fully defeated until years later, when the French invaded and colonized Algeria. But the victory of the U.S. at the Battle of Derna, it forced Yusuf Karamanli to sue for peace, and it forced him to free many of his American captives, and it put a decisive end to America's annual tribute payments. So analysts agree that this battle marked a turning point for the overall Barbary operation. dealing them a history-altering blow that helped to set them on a course that would end in wreckage. It was a pivotal success, not merely because of tactics or strategy, but because a few men of integrity refused to compromise with evil. Their steadfastness carried the day, delivering victory where lesser courage would have certainly failed. As Psalm 119, 1 through 3 declare, "Joyful are people of integrity. They do not compromise with evil, and they walk only in his paths." In the refusal of Jefferson and Eaton and his men to yield to wickedness, their honor became their weapon, and their conviction a force as decisive as any cannon. Well, thanks very much for tuning into The Sun Also Rises on KPCG-FM. Please send any questions or comments you may have to tsar@kpcg.fm. And if you'd like to know more about America's stunning ascendancy, beginning in the early 1800s, and the true reason, the spiritual reason, why this young nation unfurled its sails and came to exert its influence so effectively for so many years, please order your free copy of The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Mr. Herbert Armstrong. To get your free copy of that book, you just need to go to thetrumpet.com, click on the Literature tab, and you can order a copy of it there. Thank you once again, and I'll leave you with the words of historian Brian Kilmeade. This is the story of how a new nation was challenged by four Muslim powers. Our merchant ships were captured and the crews enslaved. Despite its youth, America would do what established Western powers chose not to do: stand up to intimidation and lawlessness.